You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world.
Okay, we're going. We're on section 137 of Contributions to Philosophy of the Event by Martin Heidegger, and the section is called Bang, B-E-Y-N-G, which is his alternative spelling of being, but we pronounce it bang to just differentiate it. It's a different kind of being. It's bang, and this book is an inquiry into what bang is. So you ready?
Mm-hmm.
After you.
137. Bang. In the other beginning, the essential occurrence of bang itself must be apprehended as the inceptual and in its full strangeness with respect to beings. Beings themselves are then no longer what is familiar, from which bang could be delineated as their more vaporous
mere vaporous
residue, as if bang were simply the not yet grasped and most general determination of otherwise known beings. In the other beginning, there is carried out the extreme transporting from beings as supposedly setting the standard, no matter how much, cf. the abandonment by being, they might still dominate all thinking.
Yeah. So in the other beginning is the beginning that we are seeking to initiate. It's a break in the metaphysical tradition that began with the Greeks. And this book is its starting point, is its first manual. In the other beginning, the essential occurrence of bang itself must be apprehended as the inceptual and in its full strangeness with respect to being. So the essential occurrence of bang is something that is inceptual. It begins things. It lies at the origin of things. And it is strange with respect to beings. it has a relation to beings, but... Well, we're about to read about that relationship. Beings themselves are then no longer what is familiar. So once bang is understood as being inceptual, in a sense, as the source of beings, and yet is fully strange to beings, it is not beings, it's not just a component of beings or an aspect of them, then beings stop being so familiar. From which bang could be delineated. So beings themselves are then no longer what is familiar. No longer, in a sense, something from which bang could be delineated as their mere vaporous residue. So bang is not just kind of some ungrasped general determination of beings. There's nothing mystical about it, vaporous, nothing just it's not just attached to being as some concept might be. It is strange and inceptual and different than that. In this other beginning that we're looking into, there is carried out the extreme transporting from beings as supposedly setting the standard. So we no longer think beings set the standard for what is. We transport away from them. Even if, admittedly, they will still dominate our thinking. We are separating from them. We are seeking a more inceptual experience and entity than them.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Bang is here not a supervenient genus, not an added cause, not something that encompasses beings by standing behind and over them. If that were the case, Bang would be degraded to the level of an addendum, whose accessory character would not be undone by any elevation to transcendence.
Yeah, that's what we pretty much said. It's not something to the side or extra or just added on, some attachment. Mm-hmm. And if that were the case, then this last bit is a little... if that were the case, if Bang were just a added cause or some addition to being, it would just be an addendum. It'd be a kind of an afterthought, a side remark, whose accessory character, so in other words, its character as just an accessory, would not be undone by any elevation to transcendence. In other words, we would not be able to move beyond the idea of Bang as just an accessory by elevating it to any kind of status as a transcendent entity. It would, in short, despite all our efforts to understand it and grant it essence, remain an afterthought and sort of a tchotchke in the drawer of being. All right, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Bang, or rather its essential occurrence, out of which and back into which beings as beings first come to be in a concealed and sheltered way. Cf. the grounding on truth.
Yeah, there's a sort of a verb missing there, but Bang, the essential occurrence of Bang is that out of which and back into which beings as beings first come to be in a concealed and sheltered way.
The question of the difference between being and beings has here a character that is totally unlike anything in the domain of the guiding question, the domain of ontology. The concept of the ontological difference, merely preparatory, transitional from the guiding question to the basic question.
Yeah, guiding question, basic question, ontological difference. Do you, who are so good at such things, remember how to define those? Because I do not.
So the guiding question, I believe, is just the question of being, and the basic question is the question of being, and the ontological difference, we were just reading.
That's the difference between being and beings, I believe. We were just reading about the ontological difference.
Yeah. I thought it was sort of... Yeah, it's the distinction between Bang and beings. So just a couple sections ago, it said Bang and beings. This distinction has been understood ever since being in time as the ontological difference.
Mm-hmm. The ontological difference between Bang and beings.
And the aim has been to keep the question of the truth of Bang safe from all admixture. Yeah.
Yeah, the question of the difference between being and beings is unlike anything else in the domain of the guiding question, which is what is being, right? Or the domain of ontology. Mm-hmm. The concept of the ontological difference, which is the difference between being and Bang, or beings and Bang, is merely preparatory, transitional from the guiding question to the basic question. It's how we get from the guiding question to the basic question, mm-hmm. The basic question being the truth of Bang. Mm-hmm. What is the truth of Bang? Mm-hmm. Okay.
The truth of Bang, in which and as which the essential occurrence of Bang conceals itself in opening itself, is the event. That is, at the same time, the essential occurrence of truth as such. In the turning of the event, the essential occurrence of truth is likewise the truth of the essential occurrence. This reciprocity itself belongs to Bang as such.
Yeah, that seems pretty clear, right? Bang is the event. And the event is the essential occurrence of truth. And in the turning of the event comes and goes. The essential occurrence of truth is the truth of the essential occurrence. Mm-hmm. This reciprocity itself belongs to Bang as such. Bang is a locus wherein the essential occurrence of truth is the truth of the essential occurrence.
The question of why there is at all truth as clearing concealing presupposes the truth of the why. But both truth and the why, the call for grounding, are the same.
Yeah, when we ask why, we're actually trying to figure out truth. We're making a call for a grounding. We're looking to ground mm-hmm. what we're asking about in some fact, in some indisputable claim, and that is the truth. So the question of why and truth are the same.
The essential occurrence is the truth itself, which belongs to Bang and arises from Bang.
Uh-huh.
Only where, as in the first beginning, the essential occurrence appears merely as presencing, does there occur an immediate separation between beings and their essence. And that is precisely the essential occurrence of Bang as presence. There, by necessity, the question of Bang as such, i.e. the question of its truth, cannot be experienced and asked.
Yeah. Important paragraph. Mm-hmm. So in the first beginning, the essential occurrence appears merely as presencing. Mm-hmm. Big theme with Heidegger. Things being present to us as beings is their essential occurrence in the conceptualization of that we've inherited from the first beginning. And only where this essential occurrence appears as presencing does there occur an immediate separation between beings and their essence. Because the being appears, it becomes present, and the being is present, and the essence is present via the being, but the essence is not always present. It is, in a sense, it's like the forms and the ideas of Plato. They aren't always present, and they aren't always a presencing. They exist outside of the presencing that exists, that happens in time. And it says, this immediate separation between beings and their essence, and that separation it becomes the essential occurrence of Bang as presence. But in the essential occurrence of Bang as presence, there by necessity, the question of Bang as such, i.e. the question of its truth, cannot be experienced and asked. Mm-hmm. Bang as presence.
Yeah, how does that?
Well, so this, I would say, goes back to sort of Heidegger's critique of time mm-hmm. and how time works. And we have the past, present, and future time of Aristotle, which went on for a long time. And so that presence is the present, and things are understood as presencing, being constantly present. Mm-hmm. And in Heidegger's more ecstatic view of time, the present is not just a static spot that is always moving along with us through time, and we with it, and behind it is the past, and in front of it is the future. It is actually a dynamic, ecstatic space that is, I believe the terms were... It was two episodes ago, maybe. One is the memorized or the remembered,
yeah.
Right? And the other is the preparedness or mm-hmm. preparing for. So it's about the relation. It's the presence is a manifold of our relationship to what is remembered and what is prepared for. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in the first beginning that emphasizes presencing as sort of the realm in which being and beings are encountered, in that first beginning, because it emphasizes presencing, this presencing de facto separates beings and being, right? Mm-hmm. Beings and their essence. And in that first beginning, or in that framework of understanding time and experiencing time, even the essential occurrence of bang is thought of as presence, mm-hmm. right? As part of the presencing. But to understand the question of bang as such and the question of its truth, you have to step out of the presencing limitations of the first beginnings time conceptualization, mm-hmm. and step into Heidegger's more ecstatic view of time and understand bang not just as part of the presencing mm-hmm. that we experience through being, but as laden by the remembered and the prepared for.
Yeah.
So it exists cross-temporally mm-hmm. and always spatially. Mm-hmm. So it's not an abstract time of past, present, and future. It's a temporal spatial playing field of being and memory and preparing mm-hmm. and bang. Yeah,
that's that section.
That's that section. I suppose we should read a little more.
Sure, sure. "138, the truth of bang and the understanding of being. Preliminary remark. If, without first heeding what was said in Being and Time about the understanding of being, understanding is taken as a kind of determining recognition of the inner lived experience, lived experiences of a subject. And the one who understands is accordingly taken as an I subject. Then a grasp of what is meant by the understanding of being is doomed to failure. The unavoidable result will be the coarsest misinterpretations, such as the view that the understanding of being makes bang, beings are actually what is meant, dependent on the subject, and that everything amounts to an idealism, the concept of which, moreover, remains obscure."
Yeah. So, he wants to say preliminarily, if one forgets what I said in Being and Time, mm-hmm. then one starts to think that understanding is a kind of determining recognition of the inner lived experiences of a subject, and the one who understands is accordingly taken as an I subject, right? Mm-hmm. So those are psychological determinations that are hardwired into the understanding of being that has not understood what is said in Being and Time. Mm-hmm. Right? So understanding is linked with what a subject lives, the experiences the subject has had, and the understanding one is an I subject. If that's the case, then a grasp of what is meant by the understanding of being is doomed to failure. There will be misinterpretations, such as the view that the understanding of being makes bang dependent on the subject, that the subject is the determination or the determiner of bang occurring or being known, and that everything amounts to an idealism, that everything is a reflection of an interior and transcendent subject that has lived experiences. Mm-hmm. So what we really need to understand, I think, here is that we're looking for a psychological framework that does not, right, consider understanding as a determining recognition of the inner lived experiences of subjects. So understanding is something other than the lived experiences of an I subject. Mm-hmm. So what is understanding? Mm-hmm. Seems important to look into, and I'm sure he will. But understanding, it needs to be separated from the I subject and lived experiences. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To oppose this view, we need to refer to the basic determination of understanding as projection. That means understanding is an opening up and is a projecting of oneself and a placing of oneself out into the open realm where in understanding one first comes to oneself as a self.
Okay, let's keep reading because we're sort of mm-hmm. hearing about understanding, mm-hmm. and then we can get a full picture of it.
Furthermore, understanding as projection is a throne projection, a coming into the open realm truth, which already finds itself in the midst of opened beings, rooted in the earth and protruding up into a world. Accordingly, the understanding of being as grounding of the truth of being is the opposite of subjectivation, since it is the overcoming of all subjectivity and of the modes of thought determined out on that basis. In understanding as throne projection, there lies necessarily the turning in accord with the origin of Dasein. The projector of the projection is a throne projector, but only in the throwing end through it. Understanding is the carrying out and taking over of the withstanding steadfastness. It is Dasein, and taking over is the undergoing, wherein what is self-secluding opens itself as maintaining and binding.
Wow. What? Yeah. So we did indeed get a new take on understanding. And understanding is projection. Understanding is opening up and is a projecting of oneself and a placing of oneself out into the open realm where in understanding one first comes to oneself as a self. So instead of there being an I subject that has lived experiences and has determining recognitions of them as if it's a kind of a closed interior self-reflective system of determining meanings and reflections and just kind of looking at what one is inside via one's lived experiences. This is a more, I would say, dynamic, external take on understanding. And it posits the idea that when you're understanding, it's probably a little less taxonomical and a little more ballistic. So understanding is part of what happens, or in a sense it's the nature of one constantly projecting oneself outward into an open realm wherein one where via understanding one comes to oneself as a self. So there's a oneself has not come to oneself yet. So one is constantly projecting oneself outward to come to oneself via understanding. So understanding is how one comes to oneself in a state of projection. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, understanding as projection is a throne projection, coming into the open realm, which already finds itself in the midst of open being. So it's rooted in the earth and protruding up into a world. So this projection is a throne projection into a world that's already there, into the earth that's already there, into the open realm of truth, which is already there. So it's constantly, as the phrase always already indicates, projecting out into something that already exists. Accordingly, the understanding of being as grounding of the truth of being is the opposite of subjectivation. So the opposite of subjectivation, meaning everything occurs in and relies on and refers to a transcendent and separate subject, it's actually a very out there in the earth, out there in the world, out there in the open realm, out there with the opened beings, out there in the throne projection. It's a dynamic external activity. Since it is the overcoming of all subjectivity and of the modes of thought determined on that basis. So understanding is actually the overcoming of subjectivity, not the recognition of subjectivity. In understanding as throne projection, there lies necessarily the turning. In accord with the origin of Dasein, the projector of the projection is throne, is a throne projector, but only in the throwing and through it. The turning is, I would say, the throwing, the throne, the projection goes out, and then it turns back to itself. The one goes out and then comes back to oneself. Understanding is the carrying out and taking over of the withstanding steadfastness. So this project of projecting oneself out into the open realm is a kind of steadfastness, right? It's a commitment. It's something you carry out. It's a steadfastness, but it's a withstanding steadfastness. So you withstand or you resist or you refuse other things. And I would say that's primarily the idea that the lived experience of the I subject is where understanding occurs. It is Dasein, their being, being there, being out there, and taking over is the undergoing, wherein what is self-secluding opens itself as maintaining and binding. Self, the Dasein is self-secluding, but the taking over, right, which he references here, the taking over of the withstanding steadfastness is the undergoing, or the action, wherein what is self-secluding, right, the self or the subject, opens itself in order to maintain and bind, to keep itself and to bind itself to things. Very active description of the dynamics of understanding with a self.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah, I've been thinking about I've been thinking a lot about how anxiety for me, aka often like intrusive thoughts, are real a real realization of the sort of first beginning way of thinking, in that it almost like it feels like it the anxiety just takes it to a very absurdist spot, an absurdist level where you have to be like, how does thought get there? Or how can logic, how can thought, how can reality actually be there? Because it doesn't make sense. And so I just think there were kind of a number of things in here that makes me think of that. And that I feel like anxiety, when it can be looked at without anxiety in a way, without excessive worry about the content, is a real potential illumination into just like false logic or false thinking or like where the logic and language and I subject and lived experience that we've grown up in, we've been trained in liberalism and sort of Western thinking, just how it really fails, because it does fail.
How does it fail?
Well, I think I think just coming back to the reading, I guess it doesn't actually make sense. It doesn't actually make sense, or it doesn't actually say a truth or feel connected to reality.
Right.
For me. So like there are just a few things in here that's like the focus on presencing of the first beginning. So for me, again, with anxiety and intrusive thoughts, it's very present. It's like, well, what if this bad thing happens right now? It like really gets rid of anything other than the present. So the sort of like fall. So I've been feeling, I've been thinking that like falling into that kind of presencing trap is a mistake, or it's like a, what do you call it? It's like a, character flaw. I don't know. Something like that. And so, and then also again, which very much relates to the lived experience being super present, getting really obsessed with a thought itself, with the subject, with the I subject, because it's always for me very related to me. And so yeah, it's does that make sense? Kind of.
Yeah. One thing I was thinking while you're talking was I think that with the non-ecstatic theory of time, which I think is very ingrained in us, and is the framework in which presencing has gained its power and its signatory role in our determinations. There's a one can almost say there's a barren space or a detachedness between the present and the past and the present and the future. They're almost how they relate is something not really talked about or understood or given a really active role in what it means to think and be and live in a world in which anxiety is even possible. So, so as you say, like the presencing that is so powerful in how we experience life leads to anxiety. Perhaps due to the fact that there's not a really thorough and perhaps subliminally implemented understanding of how the past and the future relate to this presencing. So one is stuck in an overwhelming present.
Yeah.
And
in which it feels like, or in anxiety, it feels like anything could happen in the present.
Right. Because the past means nothing.
Yeah.
Because you don't even know how it relates to the present. Yeah. And the future could be anything. Mm-hmm. because you don't really know how it should, or how it seems proper that it would emerge from what has been. Mm-hmm. So it can, so the past in a sense doesn't exist, and the future could be anything. Mm-hmm. And a future that can be anything also doesn't exist really. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I think in Heidegger's ecstatic so-called definition of time or take on time, he's not saying there's no past or future. He might be saying that there's not a past or future in the way that those words have heretofore been understood. Mm-hmm. But he's more trying to, I think, give some preliminary terms for how the past relates to the present and how the present relates to the future. Mm-hmm. And how in the present we are preparing for the future, and how in the present we are remembering the past. And those are relation words. So he's trying to give us a little bit of landscaping that we can walk around on, and not just be stuck on this little concrete pad called presence, the present. And I guess the assumption is that that will, apropos of the issue of anxiety, that that will be alleviatory. Mm-hmm. That will be helpful in escaping the present. And it sounds to me like you're kind of saying that anxiety is exacerbated by, if not caused by, the being limited to the present.
Yeah.
But of course, that being limited to the present is only actually because one hasn't taken or is incapable of taking an inventory of the past, mm-hmm. and understanding its determinative factors, you know, which are complicated to understand those factors and highly in dispute, but it is a cognitive process that is probably best undertaken. And one has not asked, well, if the future is not omnipossible, then what is possible and what is not possible? Mm-hmm. And that, too, is a very complicated analysis. Mm-hmm. But through that analysis, both of those things of which I would say are heavily part of what it means to inquire as to the essence of the truth of Bang. Mm-hmm. Those things are critical for living a life that is not the prison of the present. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't talked about identity very much in quite a few episodes, mm-hmm. but I mean, it strikes me that there's a lot of identity innuendos going on in this passage in terms of the self coming to itself, the self projecting out into itself, understanding as the throne self, mm-hmm. coming to itself, lived experience, the I subject, the transcendent I subject, the permanent I subject, the ever-present I subject, the presencing as being the in a sense the inheritance or the descendant of the I subject, all of this stuff are the accoutrements of an identitarian mindset. I think I've said it a lot of times, but you know, I think Heidegger's understanding of identity versus self wasn't fully developed, but I think that if he had had another 50 years and had been able to sit down with me a few times, he would have started to analyze the difference between a self that is dependent on the I subject and the lived experience and the interiority of that subjectivation, versus the self that is finding the self through understanding what that understanding is, how that relates to identity, how identity as the self linking and locking in to the self via projection might actually be, I would say, a stand-in for understanding. Heidegger kind of says here that the self entering the open realm and coming to the self is understanding. Mm-hmm. But of course, the self can come to the self probably without understanding, mm-hmm. perhaps. Or at least we could say there are degrees of understanding. Or at least begs the question, when the self comes to the self in the open realm, is it always via understanding? Mm-hmm. I mean, or maybe when it's not understanding, it comes to a false self. Mm-hmm. But that's very much what identity is about. Identity is the preservation of that self coming to itself again and again, repeatedly, almost, not even repeatedly, almost just monolithically and homogeneically. Yeah. Across time and space. Yeah, direct, calculate almost mathematically. He uses the words maintaining and binding, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. This is identity. Identity is the self seeks the self to establish an identity in order to maintain itself.
Yeah, identity is like a self shortcut or a self like on call. So you yes. can always hook into it and be yes. there and know that you got yourself.
Yes.
At any moment.
That's right.
So it's like the being of the self.
That's right. So that's right. And so I think it seems possible that it's an interesting extension of the text, especially given that he's talking about lived experience and the I subject, and obviously liberalism is heavy in this, in these terms, and those terms are really the yin and the yang of liberalism, and to think of the self coming to the self via projection as either being of understanding or being of identity. And I think that one reason is that I link identity to anxiety, mm-hmm. is that when the self comes to the self in identity, then that ecstatic take on time, is which is inherent to actual understanding, is bypassed mm-hmm. and rejected and ignored, and a more self-present to self. So the self becomes the agent of presencing to the self, mm-hmm. and that becomes identity. And identity is indeed kind of the maniacal, incessant presencing of the self mm-hmm. over and across what is remembered and what is prepared for. Mm-hmm. And what is remembered is altered to fit identity, and what is prepared for is only prepared for because it will preserve identity in the future. And so identity becomes, or maintaining the self, maintaining that self on call for that self becomes an obsessive compulsive activity. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's how identity and anxiety are linked, because I think, you know, So, for instance, in the scenario where presencing and the present is so dominant vis-a-vis the human character, why does that create anxiety? I don't know. I'm not sure I see like an immediate causation there. I mean, yeah, we identify that because the past and the future are kind of conceptually detached, and there's no sort of understandable causation among the components of time. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you would think that the human character would be flowing freely among past, present, and future via memory and preparedness and understanding that that's, like, nobody denies we live, I don't think anybody would deny, that we live in an ever-dynamic milieu of remembering, being, and preparing. Mm-hmm. Like, we're always doing all of those things, and mm-hmm. and they're interacting with each other. But I think that what links anxiety to presencing and how presencing becomes so causative of anxiety is the self being on call for the self via identity that is not understanding its identity. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Which is why I kind of have always emphasized like a deeper critique of identity in order to get to the bottom of anxiety.
Yeah.
Because anxiety, in a sense, identity is the compulsion that holds anxiety to the present. And the present is what exacerbates and maintains and perpetuates the anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well said.
Which is why this other beginning is so rich with, you know, possibilities for stepping out of the critical anxiety predicament that humans have found themselves in for so long. Mm-hmm. Kind of angst and fear unto death that mm-hmm. Heidegger has said is the, you know, is the incurable human condition. So yeah, I don't know. That's kind of my take on the thing.
Yeah, that's really well said. Yeah, it feels like, I think that's just really well said. And it's, in a way, I feel like it's like it's the understanding is projection. The identity version of that would be like, in a way, identity or understanding as map or like, mm-hmm. like a map that's already been drawn that you're like, know where you're going and uh-huh. you're repeating. Connecting to others through and just very established.
Yeah.
I don't know. Map just comes to mind as opposed to projection, which I always imagine as being like out onto the mountains.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's true, but
that's
sort of always been my,
my
imagination of projecting just like out into the desert or out onto the land.
Yeah.
Or just like without actually really a landing point, which is, I mean, just a little
just
challenging, but just like out. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. What you just said, what did you say before you were talking about projection?
The map?
Yeah. The map. I mean, he says, says that all of that was always already there.
Yeah.
Right. And that into which we're projecting.
Right.
And, it is a kind of a map, and it strikes me that you know, I'm kind of reading this book now. From Phenomenology to Thought or something. I mentioned it in the last episode, Richardson's book on Heidegger, he talks about the Heidegger 1 and Heidegger 2, Heidegger 1 being the Heidegger being in time and the Heidegger 2 being the Heidegger we're reading here. And the difference is often spoken of, and I think Heidegger used the word Kehre in German, which just means the turn. There's a turning. He established these concepts of being in time, and then he sort of turned on them, turned against them, turned away from them, turned back into them, and came back out. And I feel like, again, I think the work we're doing with on identity and anxiety and even the politics is a third turning. That I kind of feel like we're initiating Heidegger's third turning that he himself wasn't really able to make because he can only live so long. And and that third turning is, you know, he seems to be talking about the self coming to the self via a map, via, he doesn't really use map, but he does.
Well, I was saying the first beginning is sort of the map, like the identity is the map. I don't imagine him saying it's a map.
Yeah. I think
he says projection.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, a projection is interesting because maps are made via projection, aren't they? Mm-hmm. in a sense. Maps are projections, right?
True. Yeah.
But I guess what I'm saying is I think the third turning of Heidegger, which I think we're actually engaging in this podcast, we're sort of trying to understand for him and show what he might have gone through in a third turning. And I think that third turning is starting to ask about how the self going out and finding the self through projection and that being understanding, how projection can be and has come to be, certainly since Heidegger's death, hijacked by identity.
Yeah, right.
And I think he didn't quite get to that analysis of the risk in that situation.
Yeah.
And the possibilities of that situation not being understanding, but actually being identity. Mm-hmm. And I think that that third turning would have seen him stepping out and instead of just claiming that Dasein is the throne projection and the understanding is the self coming to the self in the open realm and that Bang is the event wherein, you know, that whereby we kind of engage with that open realm. That open realm is the event that is Bang, right? Mm-hmm. I think the third turning, is the further analysis that we're doing is sort of how all that, while being a very compelling topology of consciousness and experience does really just get hijacked by identity. Mm-hmm. How lived experience, imagination,
and the first beginning.
And then Heidegger definitely doesn't underestimate any of that. I mean, all of his writing is about saying that stuff remains predominant as hard as you try.
Yes.
But we're kind of trying to take that topology and saying, okay, how do the new obsessions and ideas of our time, what do they show us about that topology? How have they come to play in that topology, to destroy that topology, to manipulate that topology, to become major players in that topology, to bypass that topology, right? So it's really an extension of Heidegger's thinking, trying to see how his ideas have played out, and how the first beginning persists, how liberalism, in short, will not let go.
Yeah.
And continues to be
gain power.
Yeah, the palette whereby all paintbrushes gain their color.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really cool to think about as the third stage. Sort of like the new interpretation or the how does it relate today? 100 years later?
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if Derrida felt he was doing the same. Mm. And a lot of the post-structuralists, they too were trying to extend Heidegger's thoughts out into things. Mm-hmm. But they were chronically liberal, which is a stain on their reputation, obviously.
Oh, were they really?
Yeah.
I mean, I know they've been used by liberal thought since then, but they themselves were...
Oh, yeah. Well, they were Marxists.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Anyway. Okay, yes. Which is like, liberal but extra retarded. Liberal with extra retard.
Liberal squared.
Yeah, liberal. Yeah. Liberal masturbating in public. I think that's probably the best way to think of it. Anyhow, yeah. I guess that's probably it.
Yeah, sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, good stuff.
Yes.
Okay. Good night.
Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Cholla podcast. For more information, visit leapingcholla.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.